Joe, tell me what you had for breakfast today.
Well, you know what? We left the hotel in Washington at 5:45, so I didn't have a coffee till we landed here.
That's not good at all.
Yeah, no, it was a little tricky today.
Yeah, you know, be careful. Keep your blood sugar up.
Well, I had a nice blueberry muffin.
Okay, I'll take that.
Welcome to Soundboard, the Steinway & Sons podcast on artistry and craftsmanship. I'm your producer and host, Ben Finan, director of content at Steinway. If you enjoy Soundboard, please rate, review, and subscribe to it wherever you pod your casts. This episode of Soundboard was recorded live from the Big Ears Festival, held each March in Knoxville, Tennessee. Go Vols! Steinway & Sons is the official piano of Big Ears. My guest today is the Grammy-winning saxophonist, composer, and producer, Joe Lovano. He has released myriad albums for Blue Note Records and for ECM, and has performed and recorded with a long list of jazz greats, including Paul Motion, Bill Frisell, John Scofield, McCoy Tyner, Chucho Valdez, and Ornette Coleman.
Tell me what you initially learned about music from your father, and I want to know if there was a bass there that set you on your way.
My dad was one of the leading saxophone players around Cleveland in his day. He was born in 1925. So Coltrane and Miles were born in 1926, for example, you know, and Max Roach, 24. He was in that generation.
Good company.
So after he came home from the service in the late 40s, he was on the scene with all kind of folks. And in Cleveland, Tad Dameron was from Cleveland, and Albert Eiler was also from Cleveland. And my dad had a great record collection with all kind of folks, and heard Charlie Parker live, heard Lester Young, played in the Lionel Hampton band when Hamp would come through Cleveland and use pickup cats. You know, he would have his core people. And in every town, he would pick up other saxophone players and trumpet players to fill out the band, you know. So my dad would get the call for that. So he played with Hamp at that time, you know, late 40s, early 50s. All right, so just listening to him try a reed and play at home and practice, that was the whole thing for me, trying to be around him when he would play. His vibrations would fill the room. So then as a kid, I had horns and was trying to get an understanding about the elements in the music, taught me the fundamentals. And at the same time, whenever I was studying anything in any key, as far as scales and arpeggios and things, he would teach me melodies and songs in those keys that related to what I was practicing technically on the horn. 15, 16 years old, I was starting to go around and sit in and play with his groups, as well as go to rehearsals and play with others around Cleveland, mostly in my dad's generation. But then the more I got into the music, I started to have a lot of friends that were into jazz and into just the world of music. James Brown and Sly and the Family Stone and, you know. But I was developing as a soloist. So, and even in those situations, I was starting to step out from the horn section and contribute inside the music a little bit, you know. Listening to all the records and stories my dad was talking about, you know, like he played in jam sessions with Gene Ammons, for example, and John Coltrane in the early 50s when Coltrane came to Cleveland with a blues band. Coltrane was playing alto. This was before the Miles period. This was like when he was playing with Dizzy Gillespie early on. So he had Coltrane catalog, man. He collected a lot of Coltrane's records, from the earliest ones into Meditations and Kulu Sing Mama and all kinds of stuff.
Did Coltrane remain an influence for you?
And how so?
What did you take from him?
Well, you know, not only the quality of tone and the ideas about repertoire, because if you really listen to Coltrane through his different recording moments, let's say on Prestige, there's a box set of Prestige recordings. He plays 110 tunes on that, and only a handful are his original blues. The rest are all famous songs that he loved to play. That was a big lesson, that Prestige period for me, you know? And then, of course, moving into the Atlantic period, where he did about 7 or 8 records over a 2-year period, some records that had Ed Blackwell on drums and Charlie Hayden, Don Cherry, the Avant-Garde's, that record, the first one on Atlantic, but then into My Favorite Things, and Coltrane plays the blues, Olé with Eric Dolphy and Freddie Hubbard, and Elvin and McCoy started to play with him, and then, of course, the Impulse period. But my dad had records, you know, not the full catalog, but he had certain records of each of those periods, and he used to love to listen to, I used to listen to him listening to Kulu Sing Mama and Meditations.
What do you mean by that, when you would listen to him listen?
He'd be down in the basement with his stereo system. It had speakers all over the house also. And he could, if he was upstairs, he could play a record downstairs and turn the speakers on upstairs in our living room, let's say. Anyway, I would hear him down the basement listening to music. That's what I meant by that.
Secondhand listening.
Yeah, so I'm listening to him listen and learning what he was listening to. Now, this is, I'm like 12. And,
yeah. That was bedrock repertoire for you then.
That was like the school, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then he also taught me about whoever you're listening to, you're in their school in a certain way. You listen to Charlie Parker, you're in his school. You listen to Thelonious Monk, you're in that school. You listen to Max Roach's bands. You know, each player had a way of playing that was personal. Mm-hmm. And I learned that when I was a kid, you know.
Did that help you develop your personal voice? Was that something you took like, oh, okay. It's Thelonious when you hear 2 chords. You know it's Max Roach when you hear that hi-hat on automatic pilot. Mm-hmm. You know it's these guys.
Well, you know it from their language, their vocabulary, their melodic rhythm and tone, you know. Their sound. Sound is more, is beyond just the tone. It's the approach, you know. I'm feeling like now I'm having an understanding of that more in later years. At the beginning, it was just captures you. You know, you don't realize, you know, until you realize what you're listening to. You're hearing what you're listening to, but then after a while, you start to realize what you're listening to and how cats are playing, you know, and that has just developed through the years, you know.
Your sound has developed through the years?
For sure.
How so?
From every situation you're in, the different players you play with, the multi-generations you play within, the multicultural exchange that happens, your sound develops because your approach develops. You know, your tone, the quality of your tone happens from your love of the music, and it's an inner voice, your tone, but your approach is your sound. And that just develops all the time, man. When I play with different folks, you approach that sound with a different attitude. When I play with someone like John Scofield, let's say, there's a certain attitude, the way we play together, that makes the sound. When I play with Bill Frisell or Julian Lage, there's another kind of attitude, another color, another thing. You have to be flexible and free on your instrument to develop an approach about music. There's a lot of cats on the scene that play in one dimension, one dynamic the whole time they play, no matter who they play with or what tune they play. A lot of those cats play the same solo on every tune also. It's different when you really try to develop in the art of improvising and the reaction of the energy and attitude and how you could breathe together. Playing with McCoy Tyner was a certain thing, man. When I played with Hank Jones at the same period, so during those were about 4 years or 5 years, I was playing gigs with McCoy and then my quartet with Hank. Completely different as far as the attitude and the approach that you play with your sound, your tone, but also just with your ideas and breathing and sharing the space.
So your sound is not this immutable thing that you bring from trio to quartet to whomever, but you are adjusting with the players, and that's part of the improvisational process.
That's part of it, for sure. But the quality of your tone is with you always, right? Quality of my sound has developed through the years, and that's with me. What's really developed is ideas and sharing the space and the concepts about being a band leader and developing into being a band leader from playing with great leaders through the years, you know, that you learn from and you realize the embrace of others feeds you and fuels your ideas.
How does your role as a band leader change to that of, say, a sideman?
Well, you choose the material more, and then you also choose the cats you want to play with for a certain direction in the music. My trio Tapestry with Marilyn Crispell on piano and Carmen Castaldi on drums with no bass has a certain free-flowing atmosphere and I call it Trio Tapestry because we play as a tapestry of sounds and spirits in the repertoire. And I have repertoire for that group that I don't play with other groups.
What happens spatially when you remove the bass like that?
Okay, well, that gives me, with no bass from playing with Paul Motion and Bill Frisell from 1981 till Paul's passing in 2011. Bill and I played with Paul for 30 years. All kinds of music. Famous songs, Paul's originals, every now and then one of my tunes or one of Bill's, but mainly Paul's music. And with no bass, both Bill and I think, like, really developed a way of playing together that was more orchestral or, you know, like, I'm free now to accompany Bill, to take a step back into the rhythm section, be part of the rhythm section. That's what I really learned playing with Paul and Bill, was to not just be the solo voice, not just to be the preacher out front, to share the space, share melodies and create them as we move along, and then step back into the rhythm section and be part of the tapestry of the flowing of the music, you know? And that's what happens with my trio, with piano and drums. It's different, and it puts me in a role to accompany Marilyn and to get inside the harmonic sequences and the melodic flow and the rhythmic tapestry that's happening from the drums, you know? I started to really develop a way of playing in a melodic rhythm in my melodies and sounds. And with this current band, with Julian Lage on guitar and Asante Santi Dubriano on bass from Panama and Will Calhoun on drums. There's all kinds of the world of music that's in it, you know? So there's a lot of different exchanges in tempo. We play in a polytonal, polyrhythmic fashion and exploration. Mm-hmm. And the material is really fun, my original tunes. But then everyone has a real vocabulary and knowledge about music. So I could just suggest anything and we go there.
Let's say you're working on a tune with this group. Mm-hmm. What does that process look like? How does it start? Where do you go?
Well, sometimes I might just play unaccompanied at the beginning and make a statement about the melody. And then everyone listens and you lead and you follow. And in this way of playing, you follow the sound and let it take you places. And that's what I learned also from realizing what I learned from listening to Coltrane. And Pharoah Sanders and Miles Davis. When you just make a statement and set the tone of the piece, if everyone's listening and it's all about listening, the music will take you places.
You're talking about listening and you're talking about improvisation.
It's the most sophisticated way to play music. Jazz music. What is, you know, everyone says, what is jazz? You know, it's this, it's that. You know what? Jazz is an idea about how to play together. And if you really trust each other, it will unfold. But you have to trust that. Some cats have to play a set tempo on every tune, on a certain tune, a set key, a set arrangement that they repeat every time they play that same piece of music, you know. That's one way to play, but that's not the deepest way to play. For me, the deepest way to play is to let the music unfold and let it happen. Like when we play with this quartet, there's a lot of things that just emerge. Like we played the Vanguard last year. Ravi Coltrane came to hear us, okay? I saw him in there. We started, you know, in the middle of like the set, I went into one Coltrane theme, played on it, and then I changed tempos and changed keys. I went into another theme, and then another one. We ended up playing like a collage of Coltrane's compositions, but not like we didn't play each one like a full song. We played on it, we got into some things, and then I moved out of it. And everybody's listening, and all of a sudden the tempo changes. Julian's right there, you know, we're all, and I never called it. I didn't say I was going to do that at all. So we started doing that on Coltrane's tunes, on some of Thelonious's tunes, and Ornette. That week we added the Vanguard, those 12 sets. So many different things emerge as an ensemble, besides the music that I had brought in, my originals. So that concept has been a part of this group now.
To achieve that level of listening, what's the preparation for that?
You know what? I think it comes from an early age for everybody. It's just something you just think, say, oh, now I'm going to start listening. It's got to be in your rhythm spirit and in your idea about how to play. The deeper you get into this music and sharing the space with each other, that's all it's about. Playing with Hank Jones, man, was like incredible because he never repeated one voicing on any tune. He would put music up of tunes that he knew played 1,000 times, and he'd just look at the title, and the title would tell him, give him ideas. I always said, like, okay, you know that song, All the Things You Are? You play that title every time you play. Not that song, but you play that title. All the Things You Are, from the very beginning, man, from that first note you ever played on your horn or whatever. And Lee Konitz, that was one of the tunes he played a lot, man, his whole life. He played that probably on every gig. And I know for a fact he was playing that title no matter what song he played. But he loved to play that tune too, that sequence of harmonies and song. But it goes beyond that, man. And, you know, Coltrane's compositions, meditations, and different titles. He was way into that. There was one festival I played in France with Archie Shepp. Anyway, we were hanging out in the dressing room and talking about Albert Eiler. Because Albert was from Cleveland, you know? And I was hip to him in that certain directions, you know, early on. Anyway, Archie started saying that when he first came on the scene, he played in New York at the Vanguard. Him and Coltrane went to hear Albert. They were in there with a handful of people. Because his music was really like some powerful, strong statements. But his titles, Archie was saying, his titles influenced Coltrane. Because he would play Hunger for an hour. Then he'd play Love for an hour. He'd play Joy for an hour. And all of a sudden, Archie was starting to, he told me that how Albert influenced Coltrane. But of course, Coltrane influenced Albert Eiler, right? That whole thing, yeah, that the embrace. But when Archie started talking about that, man, I started realizing like a lot of Coltrane's titles from A Love Supreme on really was the feeling of the whole piece of music, you know? And that study is very spiritual and beautiful.
You've been listening to Soundboard, the Steinway & Sons podcast on artistry and craftsmanship. We heard clips from Emperor Jones from the Joe Lovano album Landmarks on Blue Note Records, from John Coltrane's Welcome from Kuluse Mama on Verve, and from Blues on the Corner from the McCoy Tyner album Quartet on Half Note Records. Our opening music is Philip Glass's Mad Rush on a Steinway Model M, played by me, Ben Finane. Our closing music is Seeds of Change from Trio Tapestry on ECM. Questions for the podcast? Email me at info@steinway.com with the subject heading Soundboard. Message me on Facebook at Steinway or hit me on the gram at Steinway & Sons. Subscribe to Soundboard on Spotify, Apple Music, Deezer, or wherever you pod your casts. Steinway & Sons is the official piano of Big Ears Festival. Thank you for listening.
All right, thank you. I'm going to get out of here. I'm going to plug your fridge back in.